Jeez.
So Mike, there's 50 years has passed since in the flash of an eye. Can you sort of briefly summarize what you did in those 50 years, and then the last part of this will be reflecting on the meaning and the significance of the arts in the small community. So
okay, sure.
Right now, what did you do when you left Wisconsin?
Well, I left Wisconsin in July of 1969, and I was I had a job then as executive director of the Indiana Arts Commission. Now, the Indiana Arts Commission was the state agency for the arts in Indiana. It had gotten underway in 1966 and it crashed and burned. The legislature was upset enough with what had gone on so that they pulled the state appropriation. And so there was a group of people that called themselves the Arts Underground that began meeting to try to get the funding reinstated. And they got it reinstated for fiscal 69. So they hired me as director. And I was saying earlier that writing my own doctoral program helped me learn to deal with new things. So it fell to me to set up the state agency as well as publicize it, because nobody knew it was there, and get programs going, start community arts councils and so on. To do this, I had a state appropriation of $25,000, which paid my salary, which I think was a princely $13,000, and secretary salary. We got the office space contributed, and then our program money was $36,000, which was the stipend from the National Endowment for the Arts for that year. So I was to meet all the state arts needs on $36,000 a year, which in Indiana at that time was probably more than enough. And so I set to work doing this, as I said, I had this Wisconsin Idea Theater philosophy that the arts belong to everybody, and so I simply went in on that assumption. And after a while, began to discover that most of my commissioners did not feel the same way. Thought the arts were something special for a special few. There were a number of commissioners who were faculty and deans from the universities and colleges in Indiana. And so they made very sure that a lot of the funding went to their institutions for programs. And the first year and a half I was fine, because I had a most remarkable chairman, Frank Thomas, who was chairman of the board of Burger Chef, which was a restaurant chain. And shortly before I got there, he'd sold it to General Foods and made enough money so that he was about 55 at the time, he and his wife retired and started doing philanthropical programs. And so Frank was the chairman, a very forceful guy, very egalitarian guy, one of the most generous people I've ever met. And he, after a year and a half or so, left. They moved to Nevada. And after that, the board just ate me alive. It was just a bloodbath. Mm-hmm. And I finally, by the end of 3 years, I was totally burned out. And finally resigned. And the board by this time was very factionalized. And the problem was, I knew all this about starting agencies. That went just fine, getting it set up and moving. But I didn't understand anything about vested interests. And I didn't understand politics. And I I think I wish in retrospect, I was about 28 at the time, I guess. And I've always thought that they should not have hired me. I mean, they should have had somebody that had more on the ground experience with government and so on. Anyway, I was totally burned out. Well, at that point, my spouse, who was then my partner, Steve, got a job teaching at Eastern Michigan University in Ypsilanti, Michigan. And he got that on the basis of the fact that he had just received a master's degree at Butler University. And so while he was working on his master's, I got a job part-time teaching drama at a Catholic girls' high school in Indianapolis, which was a very interesting experience. There were 40 faculty members, 30 of which were nuns, and 10 lay people. There were four men on the whole faculty. You raised your voice one decibel and you had total control. And then I also, at the same time, was hired by Sangamon University in Springfield, Illinois, to design their community arts program. And Karen is a graduate of that program, I think, isn't that right?
I am. Yeah, yeah. We owe it all to you. Good
no,
to
not
know.
All of it, but some of it, yes. So I did that for a year, and then, as I said, we moved to Michigan, and I got a job. I was going to spend my time writing, and a few months had passed, and no writing had happened. And so I finally took a job as a receiving clerk at a B. Dalton bookstore. And I did that for 6 months or so. And I actually am still in touch with the man who was my manager at that point. We correspond. And then I got a job with Ray Scott at the Michigan Council for the Arts, doing first community programs in connection with Art Train, which was a project that they had, and then as a performing arts director and then as community arts director for the Michigan Council. And after a year and a half of that, this was in Detroit, so you can imagine what a thrill that was. After a year and a half, I figured I didn't have anything to lose. By this time, Steve had left Eastern Michigan University and had come to work for the Michigan Council for the Arts. And not to denigrate Ray Scott's memory, but he was a horrible director, horrible administrator. Great, very effective in his work in the state and what he did, but just terrible to work for. And so we didn't have anything to lose, and so we just packed up and moved to Seattle. And once I moved to Seattle, I got a job as a professional fundraiser. And the first thing they had me do as a professional fundraiser was come back to Milwaukee in January to the home office to learn the ropes. So I'm standing on Michigan Avenue, or Wisconsin Avenue?
Mm-hmm.
I'm standing on Wisconsin Avenue, it's January. I've got a muffler wrapped around my throat about four times, and the wind came down the avenue, blew the muffler off and sent it down the street. And as I'm chasing after, I said, is this what I moved to the West Coast for, you know? So I did fundraising, which was a very valuable experience. And one of the things that I wanted to mention somewhere along the line here, we have a question coming up about what arts councils should be doing and what they should look like today. One thing that I would recommend for arts councils today is that they get some basic training in fundraising, not grant writing, well, grant writing too, but in addition to that, how to run an annual drive or how to run a capital campaign, because there's a real art to it. And once you understand that, then it's not nearly as terrifying to raise money as it seems to be at the beginning. So anyway, I did, I raised money for Lutheran Bible Institute in Seattle and then a nursing home in Tacoma. And then I got a job as development director for Seattle Repertory Theater, which is their regional repertory company in the area. And they hadn't had a development director. They needed somebody to set up a development department. And when I got there, their development files consisted of a pack of 3x5 cards about an inch and a half long, wide. And the person who had been secretary in charge of development before, when she left, had taken with her all the best cards of all the major donors, so we had to reconstruct that. So we set up the development department, and then because I was so imbued with and experienced with this idea of setting things up, once I got the department set up and moved into the second year annual drive, I was bored to death. And once again, I had bad job karma because I once again, the managing director was just impossible. And so I left there and I wanted to write. So I decided maybe I should do something part-time and not, and spend the rest of my time getting published. So I took a job at community college, Shoreline Community College in Seattle, teaching business math. Now there was nothing, if they just said you're going to do brain surgery, it would have been as likely as my teaching business math. I'm totally math phobic. And I remember saying the woman, the department head who hired me, said, well, you come up, I told her I couldn't teach it. And she said, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm development director at the theater. And she said, well, you handle the budget, don't you? And I said, yeah. And she said, well, that's business math. And I said, no, that's budgeting. I don't do math. She said, well, come up to the school, get a copy of the textbook, look it over and see what you think. So I did. I sneaked up there one noon hour and got a textbook and brought it back. And I sat down with it and I opened it up and I literally could not read what was there. But I wanted out of the job so badly that I took the teaching job anyway. And some months later, once I had been teaching it for a while, I looked back at what I couldn't read. And what it was, if you're adding a column of numbers, look for the combinations of 10 because it will make adding easier. I literally could not take that in when I started. So I would drive up the freeway every morning knowing that today would be the day that somebody would ask the question that would expose me as a total fraud. And finally somebody did. And I said, well, I don't know, but I'll find out. And then we took it from there. Well, there was a woman who was, I was part-time faculty, there was a woman who was full-time who was also teaching business math. And she and I discovered that the biggest problem that our students were having was fear of math, fear of the material. And I don't know if you know about business math, but it's all it is percentage. The base times rate equals percentage is the whole story. And you just use that in different ways and with different additions in order to do different, you know, to do bank interest or to do car payments or what have you. And so we got the idea that we should write a business math textbook with a math anxiety approach. And at that time, Sheila Tobias had just started she had just published her book, Overcoming Math Anxiety. And unbeknownst to us, math anxiety was a very hot issue. So we did a proposal, mimeographed it, sent it to 25 different publishers, and we got positive responses immediately from 7. And so we ended up writing this business math textbook, and and publishing it with Scott Forsman. And I don't think there's anything in my life that I can think of that was less likely to happen. And I after I published that book, I thought, well, I can do anything. Mm-hmm. It was an incredible confidence booster. So that book went through two editions, and then I started teaching classes in arts management there, and developed an associate degree program in arts administration for them at the community college. And I worked there for 8 years, and I never got a full-time contract. There's a rule in the state of Washington that part-timers can teach a full load, but if you teach a full load for 7 quarters, then you're automatically tenured because it's proof that they needed the position. So what they would do is give me 3 classes, and sometimes an overload, sometimes I'd have 4 classes, for like 6 quarters in a row, and then they'd drop me to 2 and then put me back up again after that, so they didn't have to contract me. Now, I don't know this, but I've always suspected that I didn't ever get a contract because of my sexual orientation. I also think that's one of the reasons that I eventually resigned in Indianapolis at the Arts Commission, but I never knew that. So as far as I know, I've never been discriminated against, but maybe I was. I just refused to recognize it. Wasn't part of my consciousness. I wouldn't believe that anybody would do something like that. So after 8 years of teaching and making about half of what the full-time faculty people were making, who had lower degrees and less experience, I finally applied for a job at the Boeing Company. And I've got it. And I went in as a technical writer, having totally sold out. You know, I would never would have occurred to me to work for a profit-making organization. And I got in there and discovered that not only were the expectations lower, but the first week, I started to walk out with my briefcase. They had given me a proposal to critique. And my boss said, "Where are you going with that?" And I said, "Well, I'm taking it home to work on." She said, "Oh, no, you're not." She said, we cannot take things out of the building." Well, for the first time in my life, I had a job with no homework. And so I did the technical writing for a while, and then I got into developing training courses, and then I became a trainer, and did that for 7 years, and then left Boeing and started my own company, and trained around the country, training technical training design and computer-based training design. And did that for about 5 years. Went all over the country. It was very interesting. I got so sick of getting on and off airplanes, and then I retired after that. So I retired at about 58.
And now you're taking art.
Oh yeah, in the state of Washington, once you turn 60, you can take classes free at most community colleges and at the state university. And so the minute I was 60, I was all over that. I started taking art courses, and let's see, I was 60, then I'm 73 now. I've been taking ever since. And what I do is go over the community college is about 10 minutes from the house via bus, and I go over there 4 days a week and sit in the back of the room and paint while the teacher paints a class.
So you're paints back to your arts roots, and actually yes. I see themes. I mean, whether you've been at Boeing or in business for yourself or grant writing or at the Arts Commission or at the University of Wisconsin, there's sort of a theme of opening doors for people and enabling yes. things to happen that people maybe didn't even think could happen.
Yeah, that's true. And one of the great vehicles for that is teaching. I mean, when I finally got comfortable with teaching business math, I loved it. I started teaching grant writing and fundraising, and then I, as I said, I went to work for a technical in technical writing, and then they were looking for somebody to teach some management classes, and didn't have enough people to do it, so they borrowed me to teach. And the first day when I walked into the classroom, I just felt myself come to life again. Mm-hmm. And so the teaching aspect has always been very important. I love teaching.
And opening doors.
And opening doors, yeah.
So let's sort of switch to the kind of reflection mode, unless anyone has any questions about Mike's career per se. So it's now 1992, and Professor Gard passed away. And Mike and Professor Gard hadn't had any contact during this time for years.
For years, yeah.
And I guess, Mike, you saw the announcement of Gard's death in the Seattle paper.
No, I don't think that was it. I think someone from here sent me the obituary out of the Madison paper, I think is what happened.
I see. So you wrote Mrs. Gard, and she showed the letter to me and said, Mike's in Seattle. Because we'd wondered, I had known you when I was a high school student, we wondered where you were, and I wrote you back, and you said, well, as a matter of fact, my consulting work is bringing me to Denver next month, and I was living in the Denver area, so Mike and I reconnected, and so I was able to tell you what had happened in the community arts field since you had left it. And that brings us to the current conversation. So, Harv, do you want to?
That would be, before you start, Harv, let me say something about that first meeting after all these years. We kept discovering all these things in common. I said something about my assistant at Michigan, Joe Zindel, and Mary said, well, I know Joe Zindel. I deal with him all the time, you know, and so on. And we talked further, and there was this person and that person that we both knew in common. And Mario was driving me back to my hotel, and I said, I had a student in Seattle who was going off to manage the Telluride Film Festival, and I taught her grant writing. I said her name was Kate Sibley. And Mario pulled over to the side of the road and stopped the car, and she said, I'm in love with her brother. so there were all of these connections. So anyway.
Obviously this conversation was meant to be. And later, by the way, for the record, I married that self-same brother.
Yeah.
So Harv, do you want to just sort of...
I'd like to launch, but I think that was an important piece of the conversation to have, so thank you for sharing that. We haven't really talked about the arts in a small community and the end of the project and the report out. So I want to talk about that. But before you tell us that, I'm sure that you're as surprised as other people that indeed it was reprinted at least three times and now is available online like so very many other books. So whatever you might have thought about it at the time, it perhaps has a different outcome than you realized then. So we want to comment on that.
I'm utterly blown away by that. I knew we were doing an important piece of work when we wrote the national plan. But I then left Wisconsin, and I remember calling Professor Gard's secretary, Anita Reedy, and asking her to send me some copies. So she sent me a bunch of copies, which I distributed in Indiana. But then went on to do my own work in Indiana and then in Michigan. And partway through that time, we had a consultant from New York come, Omar Lerman, who was one of the great arts developers, and he brought with him a woman. They were on their way to a conference, and the two of them stopped in Seattle on the way, or in Detroit on the way, and they we had cocktails, and she turned to me and said, "You were at University of Wisconsin, what did you do?" And I said, "Well, I was involved with the Arts and Small Community Project, and we wrote this little book called The National Plan." She said, "You wrote the Bible?" And at that point, the first inkling I had that this publication had a life. And then as I got re-involved and got talking to Mario, I discovered that it had become the Bible of the Community Arts Council movement in the United States. It's the most important thing I've ever done as far as influence on people. And I, as I say, I'm simply blown away by the fact that simple little book, and it was simple for a reason. Professor Gardy insisted that it be simple. Ralph and I were both very wordy and very filled with our artistic and academic achievement at the time. And so we wanted it to be very flowery and very full of philosophy and so on, which, as I indicated earlier, should have been a different book. And he kept saying, "I want something for the people, something that people can use." And so we ended up laying it out using the photos from, oh, we forgot to talk about Life magazine.
We'll have a chance to come back to the things.
Don't let's forget Life magazine. Anyway, we filled it with photographs that had been taken by a Life photographer for an article that never happened, and made it as user friendly as we could. And that turned out, the professor, as usual, was absolutely right. You know, it turned out to be something that was infinitely usable for people. And I really feel very humbled at having been a part of that project.
Before we move from the book and its reprinting multiple times, we often talk about how the Christmas tree books.
So
the arts and books that accompany it. And you'll be interested to know that Bob Lynch, who heads American for the Arts now, is going around a lot talking about the arts and. So can you comment on the various books about the arts and health or religion?
Oh, the supplements?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah, there's the Christmas set, which was named that because one is red and one is green, and they're little chat books. And what they are principally was proceedings from that conference I mentioned that we had. I think did Ralph Burgard write one of the things in that? Ralph Burgard was at the conference. Ralph wrote one. Several people contributed to those, and we distributed thousands of those. But then at the same time, I honchoed a list or a series of supplements. Now, I thought those had been pretty much forgotten. I'm delighted to hear that Lynch is going around talking about them, because in each one of those, we went into some detail about how to involve religion, how to involve local history, how to involve. And so there were, I think, 15 supplements. And there's another thing as well. I have a distinct memory that after I left Wisconsin, Ralph published a third volume, which was in navy blue, that had the windmill on the front and was to go with the Christmas set. I do not have a copy of it. I have no assurance that that it ever really existed. I may have imagined it, but I, if anybody is within hearing of this tape, who has or has seen a copy of the third book, it would help me not feel so crazy.
Do you remember what the content of that third
no,
book was?
I don't. I don't, which is one of the things I think I may have, reasons I think I may have made it up. But I have a very distinct memory of it. But yeah, those supplements were very, we just ran them off on the mimeograph, and they were little small books. I think they're on, aren't they on the Wisconsin Idea Theater website?
The yeah. Guard Foundation website, yeah. Yep, they are. Actually, this probably, you wanted to mention Life magazine, this probably would be a good time to mention it because it's part of the book.
Yeah.
You want to just tell us how you happened to get the Life magazine connection, or what that was?
Well, I should be able to do that, but I can't remember how we made the connection. But Life magazine, which in those days was quite a force, I mean, it was a weekly magazine, and they sent a reporter named Susanna McBee, who I think later became a reporter for McCall's. They sent Susanna McBee out, and they sent a man named Declan Hahn one of their photographers. And they worked mostly, well, they went to all the test communities, except perhaps Rhinelander. And Susanna compiled material for an article for Life magazine. And Hahn took reams of pictures. It was where I learned that what professional photographers do is just take thousands of pictures and then call them out, which is why they get such good stuff. Well, ultimately, Life did not publish the article. They decided it was not of enough interest, and they didn't publish it. But the photographs existed. So when we got ready to write the national plan, we contacted Life magazine, and they sold us, for I think 50 cents a print or whatever, they sold us the pictures. And so we had this wealth of material that we could dig through to find the photographs for the book. So that's where that came in.
That's great, thank you.
Great. So another reflective question. We talked about how in the five communities, arts councils, local arts councils were one of the things that happened. So you set those up, visited them again in 2006. Some of them, as we've discussed, are no longer there. Some are still functioning. One is still functioning. Do you think that something started in motion from that process that still has implications today?
Yeah, absolutely. The Rhinelander School of Arts is just starting its 51st season. As we talked about earlier in the day here, the Arts Council there is very active and very vital at this point. In Spring Green, there is the American Players Theater, which how long has that operated now? 30 years, probably 30 plus years. When we visited them, it was very clear that there's a whole lot of activity going on in the arts in the Spring Green area. And wasn't the Worm Farm out there at Dodgeville or somewhere close at hand like that there?
Reedsburg.
There's a lot going on there. And as I said, I doubt if you talk to anybody that they would even remember that the project took place. But it got embedded in the thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not weird to have an idea about wanting there to be arts programs. Adam's Friendship has very active community theater. I guess I talked about this before, didn't I? Or was that on a break that I talked about?
I think you mentioned it.
Yeah, okay. And then Portage has a dedicated art center that has operated a nice theater and gallery. Waupun, as I mentioned, has the fiber arts program still going on. And then the major finding from the restudy, and I'm sitting here acting like I did it. I mean, I did maybe 3 or 4 interviews. Mario put my name on it because she thought it would be nice to have a connection to the old project, but I didn't really do very much. I just gave moral support mostly. But the one finding that was significant was that people in those test communities to this day have a stronger expectation that the arts will be part of the community life than they do in other places. And that, I think, is very important.
What Mike's referring to is that we did, as in 1970, did a small statistical study about attitudes towards the arts in those 5 communities compared to 5 similar communities that hadn't had the project. And then we repeated that study in 2006 and noticed that there were, even though there was a lot of time had passed and you couldn't make causal connections, there was still an attachment to the arts and an expectation of the role of the arts in the community in those 5 test communities that there wasn't mm-hmm. in the others. So I think it's a good time to take a break, unless, Mike, you have anything you wanted to say, just to wind this section up about 2000, to kind of close out Anne's question about what's happened, the continuing impact.
Well, I think the other thing that we haven't mentioned is that in 2006 we rewrote the Arts in the Small Community book and brought it up to date with what's happened since. Now, once again, Mario wrote it, and then she sent it to me to edit. And what I asked her in reading the new version was, not wanting to violate copyright or getting permissions and so on. She had said, "We know of a community that does such and such," or "There is this community that does such and such," without naming anything. And I emailed her back and I said, "You know, I really think that we're missing the bet by not identifying these places, because we now have examples all over the country of this kind of thing happening." And so she did that, and by the time we published it, we were able to say, in Boulder, Colorado, this happens, in Peoria, Illinois, this happens, and so on. So it really made it, we retained a lot of the, well, most of the original writing, mm-hmm. but we added all these examples from other places. And then also, help me remember, Mario, we put in a page of questions.
The whole notion was to make it a do-it-yourself
manual.
So that with each topic, for example, the arts and religion, or the arts and health or history, as you mentioned,
it was
several
questions
that you
to ask.
Have in your own group
topic
area.
Which I think was very, I don't know how much it's been used, but I think it was very, a very helpful addition. The other thing we did was we got the opportunity, thanks to the Wisconsin Arts Board, to do a workshop at Rhinelander during the School of the Arts for community arts leaders. And we put together what I think was a very robust design for a good workshop based around the book. And we had, 25 people there probably? And we had to make some modifications as we went along, because you know how that always is the first time you do something. And we had a great response to it. I mean, it just felt good. It was a good workshop. And so we wrote that up and turned over the curriculum and the time schedule and so on to the foundation, or we actually gave it first to the community arts people from all the different state arts councils, and then I think it's on the website, the foundation website at this point, I believe.
I think so.
And I don't know if anybody has ever picked it up and done it, but it was a, and for me to be co-presenter in that workshop was a great, I didn't know if I could do that kind of thing anymore, because it was some years after I'd retired, and I didn't know if I could stand up and teach for 8 hours anymore. And we just had a great time, very exciting group.
Bringing the work up to date and putting it out there again.
Yeah.
So let's take another 5-10 minute break. Thanks, Mike, and we'll reconvene shortly.
Okay.
This is Karen, the next question's mine. In the spirit of the book, your book, do you think that arts councils being formed today are or should be different from the ones that you helped to form?
Not in any material way. I think that I believe, I recognize I've been out of the field for a long time, but I believe that the way arts councils were structured then is probably in many cases still sensible today. If I were to make any differences, I would urge them to be more inclusive, as inclusive as possible, and also to concentrate, not to neglect the arts per se, but to concentrate more on creativity. That there are so many things that I think of now as the arts that I didn't used to. I mean, things like cooking and hair design and computer programming and a whole variety of pursuits that can be looked on as having to do with the arts because they have to do with creativity. And I think one of our great tragedies in this country is that even though we do some things, we could do so much more to foster personal creativity in people. And I think that's a very important role that a community arts council can play. I would, if I were to recommend, I would recommend arts councils today paying less attention to importing arts programs from outside and concentrate more on developing them within the community. This is a whole different world from the way it was 50 years ago. When we were doing the restudy in 2006, I interviewed a woman over in Waupun, and I said, do you bring in shows here? And she said, well, no. She said, people that want to go to shows get in the car and drive over to Madison, which is like 60 miles. Well, in the days of the grant, we drove 60 miles, but it was a big undertaking, and you certainly wouldn't do it at 11 o'clock at night after seeing a performance. Now that's not a big deal anymore. And now we have public television, we have performances on other television, on cable networks and so on. And so I think the outside performance isn't as cost effective as it once was. I also think that arts councils of today should spend some time, or quite a bit of time, defining what art is. There are as many definitions as there are people. Everybody who thinks about the arts thinks about it in a different way. And as I mentioned in my experience at Indiana Arts Commission, to me the arts was including people, getting out into communities, making things happen, bringing the arts to people, bringing people to the arts, bringing the arts out of people. And I had board members who, that whole concept was absolutely anathema. The arts were something that was to be viewed on a pedestal. And I think one of the big problems is that we all think we know what art is. And yet, we find ourselves working often at cross purposes because we define it differently. So that's one thing that I think is very important. When we do a third rewrite of the Arts in a Small Community book, we should put that in, I think.
It's on the record that you said, when we do, I'll tell you.
Okay, I am sure you will.
So I wanted to just explore something for a second. You know, one of the things that seems, might be true, is that the word creativity seems to be a more inclusive word than arts. And I don't know if you'd want to comment on that. When in our work as community arts development people, we talk about a creative district, for example, people have said that invites me in, mm-hmm. where if you called it an art district, that would exclude me because I don't know art. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely right on. I think we tend to define art too narrowly, and if we do that, we leave people out. My hometown, Neillsville, has never had an arts life particularly. It's not a big concern, and that always, I've always felt kind of guilty about that because I should have been able to do something about that when I was working at the university here, if nothing else. However, I discovered a few years ago that they have a very, very active historical society, and they have divided up the task of collecting historical material for Clark County and have an absolutely phenomenal website that has obituaries, it has pictures of the cemetery, it has old photographs, it has complete people from all over the country who have came from that area or ancestors in that area, access that Clark County website, which was done by the local historical society. So whether it comes out as something we define as art or not, this business of creativity is bubbling up all around us and coming out in one way or another. You know how you become, or maybe you don't know, I've become pretty curmudgeonly. And before I started preparing for these interviews, I had a real negative opinion about how passive everybody was and how nobody did anything anymore. And then I'm starting, I live in Seattle now, and I'm starting to notice that every neighborhood has a festival of some kind. Every weekend in the summer, there's something going on. There are a couple of huge art fairs. There are, our little community of West Seattle has a sidewalk sale, and there are all kinds of things like that. So people are creating, people are doing things. And look at you know, I think I mentioned earlier this, we don't define the music industry and commercial art and television and movies. We don't define those as art, but it's all creativity. And simply because of our narrowness in refusing to recognize it because it turns a profit, I think the best thing that could happen is if somebody started a real saturation campaign about how popular the arts are. Actually, in my painting class the other day, there was a young woman who's a welder. She's a perfectly marvelous young woman, and we were talking about this coming up and so on. And she said, "Well," she said, "perfectly obvious." She said, "Young people don't care about these things." She said, "If somebody started an advertising campaign and published these, that would be all the goal. Everybody would go to the symphony if they thought that it was the thing to do." Well, she's absolutely right. You know, why do we have this mentality that the arts have to be starving? you know, what's wrong with making money? That's one thing I learned at University of Wisconsin that I had to get over was, in those days, making money was sinful. I mean, you just did not make money. You didn't work for a profit-making corporation. A lot of people figured out how crazy that was before I did. But I, you know, that's within the realm of possibility, and it's something that could happen.
So if, you know, as I'm thinking about what you're saying, it seems like the significance of all of this work in the 1966 to 69 period was kind of, perhaps the word is access, giving people, wherever they lived, access to the arts and recognizing that they had the right, a word you used, to have the arts in their community and to participate in the arts. And that's sort of a cluster of things. That's access, exposure, opportunity. Are you saying that this next frontier is making the shift to a broader idea of creativity, kind of blurring the line between the things that was used to be defined as art per se? What do you think the frontier is right now that arts councils could be addressing?
Well, that's hard because I don't know what they are addressing. I mean, I'm totally out of it. I don't know what they're doing. So what I'm saying, maybe people listening to it may think, well, we've been doing that for 20 years, you know. But I think that creativity is important. I think continuing to break down the idea of elitism. I think I don't know if that's still the problem that it was. I know that it absolutely needs to be destroyed. The art being for the few and inaccessible to the general public in a democracy, particularly when public money is involved. I think it's criminal not to make it inclusive. And yet I realize that we are all, or many of us, are automatically victims of that. We had a problem at the condominium the other day of water leaking into the unit below ours, and the plumber came and was flushing the toilet multiple times to try to see if the water would run down. And he looked at some of the paintings in the apartment, and he said, and he started talking about art and about how he had developed an interest in visual art and started talking about various artists and so on. And I'm standing there thinking, oh, isn't this wonderful? This plumber is thinking about art. Well, I mean, he could have been a neurosurgeon for all I know who got into plumbing for the money. I mean, you know, who am I to sit there and think that this man is a plumber and so therefore he should not know anything about the arts? And so I realized that I need my own consciousness raised about that. That's one thing that we found out 50 years ago when we went into these small communities, that the people that we ran into were working, selling visual artists, people with more degrees than we had at the university, people of native intelligence as well as educational intelligence. Who are any of us to decide that somebody else either isn't fluent in the arts or shouldn't be?
So we're lucky. We're dreaming ahead. And we're lucky because we just wrote a grant to the National Endowment for the Arts. And we just got a similar amount of money adjusted for inflation for this project going forward. What would we do with that money? What would we have proposed? What would we be doing with that money? And would we still be focusing on small communities?
First, we would be totally amazed that they had forgotten about the first project by now. But I think if we got another grant, and if I were involved with it, I think the first thing I would do is make sure that we wrote that that book of philosophy of community arts. I think one of I'm of the opinion, you're going to love this, I'm of the opinion that arts administration and arts development is not a profession. It doesn't meet the criterion for profession. We have no certification program. Anybody can walk in tomorrow and take your job if the governor happens to like them better. There's no accountability. There's no protection. You know, if you lose your job, there's no American Medical Association to come along and protect you. I think we need to make strides toward the things that go into making a profession, one of which is developing a literature. And even now there's some of that has been done, of course, but scientific research. If I were going to do the grant project now and I were in charge of it, I'd make it much more scientific than it was. We would go in advance to the communities, interview and do questionnaires about attitudes toward the arts, and then we do the same thing at the end of the project. We would have test communities that we kept track of, that are not test communities, control communities that we kept track of to deal with. There needs to be in the field a body of scientific research, and I would like to see much more of that done. Now, in this project, the original project, that didn't make sense because, first of all, it was pioneering, and you always do case study research when you start pioneering something. Also, it was absolutely anathema to the way Professor Gard thought. He was a man of action. He wanted to make things happen and do things. He didn't have any truck with scientific studies. In fact, I was getting ready to write the final report to the National Endowment after 3 years working on the project. And I thought, well, I'll go back and read the original proposal. And when I did, I discovered that we had control communities. Never had heard that there were control communities that he took control communities very literally. It's you did nothing with them before or after and had no truck with them in between times. And we never went back and found out what happened in those communities in the media. And that kind of thing should be built into a project of this kind at this point. I would also want to do some study, and I wish with all my heart somebody would do this. We've alluded to the effect on individuals previously. I believe it would help arts developers so much if they were able to chart what the effect was on individuals from programs that we mount. We've talked a little bit about how the effects of the grant program still manifest themselves in these communities. Well, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could do a longitudinal study over two or three generations of what happened? I mean, could we find out why that fellow is working at the Kennedy Center now? Could we find out how what's happening in Spring Green now relates to what happened with the Uplands Arts Council? I saw this in the Finnish American project to Hurley, people whose lives were absolutely changed by participating in that project, and I'm going to be interested when I go up there later on this week, where I'll be talking to the children and grandchildren of the people that I worked with, to see exactly what their attitudes are about folk arts at this point. So that's why I would give it a much more scientific bent.
And would you still look at the small communities as you do all that? Would you broaden that, or would you narrow it even to smaller?
Yeah, well, you've got to look at something, and small communities would be as good a thing as any to look at, but I feel very strongly that the problems and opportunities that we've been talking about today affect all communities. I mean, I think very strongly that that the Arts in the Small Community book, for example, is as applicable to an urban neighborhood as it is to a small community. So I think all communities need this kind of program going on.
I'm glad you said that, because that sort of relates to my next question, which is, it seems so silly to ask it this way, but what's this book about? You read The Arts in the Small Community, a National Plan book. It's profoundly moving. You remember many, many of the words. You remember the stories. And there are many takeaways. And I wonder if these are the things I'm about to list are all things that you all were thinking about when you wrote the book, or if we're missing the point altogether. For example, I could read the book, and there's so many words about the importance of the arts in a democracy. So to me, that's one of the themes of the book. Then George mentioned the whole theme of arts and, because you have 17 sort of mini chapters, the arts and religion, the arts and cultural groups, the arts and business and health and. So one theme could be the arts linking to everything, to all of the different systems and ways that communities are. Others say that the book is a very pragmatic how-to handbook. How do you set up an appropriate arts council for your community? And some say that no, it's an anthem about rural America. Is it about all of those things, or are we missing the point?
No, I it is about all of those things. And that's a very, very good list. I would say the one thing that is a distinguishing feature is those art and parts. Because at that time, the idea of arts and sports, arts and medicine, arts and hospitals, arts and schools, well, not schools so much, but arts and historical societies, that cross-fertilization was a pretty unheard of concept at that point. So that is important. I would say, in addition, I, as I say, all those things you said are true. In addition, I would say that the overall purpose is to help people realize that participation in the arts is a basic human right, and that wherever you are, whatever the community, whatever the area, you can do something to improve and enhance that participation. I really think that was our purpose. That and then something that we had mentioned before, the accessibility of the book itself, that it is simple. You know, when I wrote the business math book, we wanted to have a wealth of word problems and so on. And so we ended up with a 600-page book. And the first time I got to teach out of it and passed it out to my class, they looked at it, and I suddenly realized by the expression on their face that they were utterly intimidated by the volume of the book. Well, look at this simple little 100-page book and how you walk through it, and it leads you through from step to step to step and helps you build as you go. It's a little like the Betty Crocker cookbook. You know, the Betty Crocker cookbook is something that I've used for over 50 years. And it's set up in such a way that as you advance as a cook, you discover that Betty had it all figured out. You know, you get to the point where you want to make pettifors. There's been that recipe there all the time. That's the way this book is. It helps you, it takes you wherever you are and moves you further along the continuum.
Well, and I remember when we looked at updating it in 2006 when the question came up of copyright, and you pointed out that the original book was deliberately not copyrighted so that people would use it and would photocopy it. And as I recall, what we agreed the language would be is this book isn't to be copyrighted, but we just ask that people edit it when they use it.
Well, we also, of course, were publishing it using funds from the grant. So it was a government-sponsored book, so we really couldn't. I've always thought that if we had been able to copyright it, I'd be a rich man at this point, because it sold way more than my math book. It sold way more than my novels. It sold way more than my way more than my book of poetry. And it's you know, by far the most popular thing I was ever involved in writing.
Well, and as I recall, you all gave it away. We found in the archives at the University Steenbach Library letters from State Arts Council and local arts councils and communities all over the country saying, I'd like 50 copies, I'd like 20 copies. But in that same spirit, it's free on the internet.
Yeah.
One thing, Mara, just as we're thinking about and reflecting on the impact of the book, we always go back to the altering the hearts and minds of America. And it's interesting, we're thinking on that level, but what we come to today, and you said it multiple times, is the altering the hearts and minds of the community member or the individual.
Yeah.
And that sort of gets lost in this transition, because we're thinking up here, and yet it's so fundamental here, which is, I think, its ultimate impact over time, is that it's hitting people where they live.
Yeah, I agree.
So as we wind up this section, and then we'll have a moment for a few more reflections after the break, is there anything that might have been said that could trigger any final questions?
Yes, I have one. And this makes it sound like I haven't had this question all day, because I've had this question all day. I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, and I'm sorry it's taken so long to get to this point. It's all on me, about your sexual orientation and how that plays into your work. I'm not sure how to ask it except just to ask it. So the question I usually ask is about coming out. So maybe we start with that. I know it's a different process for each person, but if you wouldn't mind talking about it.
But also, for many people, although I suspect that there are a lot of small towns where it's still just as difficult as it used to be. But remember, I'm an Eisenhower faggot. I was born in 1940. I grew up in a town of 2,500 people. I was raised Catholic. There was no way to talk about this or to even think about it sanely. I knew that I sensed that there was something different about me. To my amazement, discovered that I was sexually stimulated by something different from anybody else I knew. I thought there was something deeply wrong with me. I did everything I could to go through the motions of trying not to be that way. I was absolutely isolated. There was nobody to talk to about it. And I am so overjoyed that young people of today don't have to go through that. I mean, many of them may still go through it. I mean, the suicide rate of teenagers, gay teenagers, is a national disgrace. But there are alternatives now. There are ways to understand. I mean, we see characters on television. We see characters in the movies. We hear Oprah talk about all this. It's a different world now from the way it was then. So it was very difficult, and I believe that my outlook and sexuality and attitudes about same are very skewed and relatively unhealthy compared to what they could have been if I had been given any ability to accept myself and to realize that I wasn't absolutely alone. I think I said earlier on that as I look back, I can think of several job situations where I'm sure I was discriminated against. But that wasn't in my consciousness. I kind of refused to believe that anything like that could happen. Because at the same time as all this unhealthiness is going on, one realizes that they're just who they are. You know, that my sexuality is no more or less important than which side I part my hair on or what color my eyes are. And I believe that it's taken me, I believe that it's taken me almost until today to get comfortable enough to really talk about it and think of how sad that is. You know, it's just a sad, stupid thing. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough and fortunate enough to find a soulmate when I was in my very early 30s. And Steve and I have now been together for going on 44 years. And I am absolutely delighted when our heterosexual friends say, gee, you've been married longer than anybody we know. Mm-hmm. And I consider myself as screwed up as my head was about all this, that we've been able to make a life for ourselves and have been able to reach the point where it's no big deal, where we're proud of it. We got state of Washington has legalized same-sex marriage now, and shortly after they did that, we got married, which surprised both of us because, you know, as Steve always says, it never occurred to me to think of being married. And so we really kind of don't know how to handle it in some ways. I call him my spouse because, you know, if I call him my husband, what the hell does that mean? Am I the wife? You know, I mean, the terms just don't apply, you know. So it's kind of breaking new ground in a lot of ways. But yeah, I think it's largely a myth, but I'm not so sure it is, that sexuality is attached to creativity, I believe I'm more creative because of my orientation and also because of my dyslexia. Because you're used to being, or once used to being a maverick, that it's not quite so difficult to do mavericky kind of things. So there are some good things that have come out of it. But there are also things like, as I mentioned a moment ago, things where if I had been more self-aware or more aware of my surroundings, where I could have been very badly hurt by what happened, losing jobs and so on. But I just simply didn't allow myself to feel that way. And so I would say it's been an interesting journey. Would I choose it? No. I think that anybody who says, when did you choose to be a homosexual, is full of it. I mean, that's insane. It's like my asking you, when did you decide you were going to be heterosexual? It's not something you decide. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with gaining enough self-awareness and acceptance of who you are till you can finally say, yeah, this is what it, where it is for me. And like I said, I wouldn't choose it. And in another lifetime, I probably won't choose it again. But it's not been that bad this time, especially because I've had the love and support of a good man.
Mm-hmm. I could ask a lot more, but I'm going to reserve the right to talk to you again about this.
Oh, sure. So, yeah.
And I know there's final questions that the group wants to ask. But thank you for that. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
So let's take a final couple of minutes break, and then we'll be on the home stretch of the last few questions.
Okay.
So these are the final few questions, Mike, and I would certainly invite anybody around the table to probe on any of the answers that you are talking about, or just ask questions of their own as we wrap up. But I'd like to start in 2006 when we revisited this whole project. I remember a group of us sitting around the table reflecting on what it means to be an insider and an outsider. And you started the conversation, I think, because you were talking about how you and Gard and Ralph were outsiders, and you were in the role of coming into communities and trying to alter the heart and face of America as outsiders. And we had quite a lot of conversations about the role of insider and outsider. A lot of people doing this kind of work, including several of us around the table, are outsiders when we go to communities. And then you have outsiders who are part-time residents in communities. What does it mean to be an insider and an outsider? And is there a different role that each of these people has to play in building a community and altering the face and heart of the community and its individuals?
Well, by my definition, being a community arts developer means that you're an outsider. Now, that's not strictly true because, you know, I mentioned Herb Kinney, who was the county agent in Iron County when I was there, who was a member of the community, lived in the community, but his job was community development. But most of us who go through programs in community development and community arts development end up playing the role of outsider. That was what Professor Gard did in all of his work. And I think it's a very important role, because the insiders in the community, the people who live there, can propose something as a good idea that might be done, but when somebody from outside comes in and supports that, or makes other suggestions with it, it has a certain impact. One definition of expert, you know, is somebody who's 50 miles from home and has slides. And that role and that place, somebody coming in and helping stimulate local thought and give some importance to what can happen, it's a very important function and one that you can't emphasize enough. That was the role that I played in the National Finnish American Festival in Hurley. I mean, here was living in their community a representation of the fact that the University of Wisconsin cared enough to see a local program happen, that they would supply a resource for it. So I think that role, that outsider role for a developer is a very important, probably the key role. As to part-time residents and full-time residents or new residents in a community, I think they have to be very, very careful, because there used to be, maybe this is all different now, but there was a real tendency to resist somebody coming into the community as a resident and trying to change things. That change was not good. I remember when I lived in the northern part of the state, when I was with the Finnish Festival, I lived in Montreal, Wisconsin, and there was a woman that came in who bought three or four of the houses and was a very wealthy woman. She was, I think she was coal and her husband was steel, or the other way around. They were from Philadelphia originally, or Pittsburgh originally. And she had wonderful ideas about how that community, which was, it was a company town. So the houses were of an era and of a same design and so on. It was a very charming place. And she had some wonderful ideas and started pushing things about how they could make it into a real show place and a tourist attraction. And partly because she was rich, partly because she was out from outside, people there fought her tooth and nail. And she eventually ended up selling her houses and leaving the community because they so resented the idea that she wanted them to keep the houses all painted white and wanted it to present a uniform front. So I think it's very easy as a new member of a community, whether full or part-time, to make a mistake. Now, on the other hand, when we were interviewing in 2006, I interviewed a woman who had been part of the original Waupun project, who now lives in Green Lake. And she said that she was so delighted to live in Green Lake because it was such a different atmosphere from Waupun. She said there were so many people who were retired up there from Chicago. And she said if they wanted a piece of public sculpture for the square, they had a cocktail party and raised the money. And she said they know how to do some of these things that we don't know how to do in small towns. And so it's a two-edged sword, but I think you have to be very, very careful not to push your weight around. I remember when I was taking my speech and English method classes when I was a senior here, I remember Gladys Borchers saying, she said, you have to be very careful as a new teacher. She said, when I had my first teaching job, we had a teacher's meeting and there was a new teacher who had all these ideas and brought them up in the meeting and so on. She said, I felt so inferior and I felt so kind of jealous because she had all these ideas. And she said, we were walking back to our classrooms and she said, I heard the older faculty members all saying, well, who does she think she is coming in here? And I think that's a very real consideration.
What do you think if a young community arts developer came to you and said, what are the most important traits of a community arts development person, a specialist, what would you say those are?
Humility. I think you need to go into a community ready to listen and ready to learn. I think you need to get used to the idea that you're going to present good ideas and not have anybody hear them. And then 15 minutes later in the meeting, somebody says, wouldn't it be a wonderful idea if we did so-and-so and parrots exactly what you said, and nobody countenances the fact that you were the one that said it. I think it's important to be able to say the same thing in different ways so that you can repeat the idea several times without people thinking you're a broken record. I remember that was something I learned when I was teaching business math, that I would explain a whole process and then somebody would raise their hand and said, but what about so-and-so? And it would be exactly what I just talked about. And so I'd have to figure out a way to say it the same thing in a whole different way so that they wouldn't feel like they were idiots. And I think that trait is an important one, that you need to be able to hammer again and again and again without sounding like you're doing that. I think patience is an important aspect of it. When I was working with the Finns, I was, you know, I was very young and of course very impatient, and they didn't move fast enough for me. And finally, Gene Compsey, the person I mentioned earlier, took me aside one day and he said, you know, he said, when you're working with Finns, you've got to understand something. He said, we're very slow to take on an idea. But he said, it's like a big rock rolling downhill. He said, once it starts, it may move very slowly, but it keeps moving. And, you know, here we are 50 years later, and that rock is still moving down there. And so I think that, you know, just like we were talking about the effects of the book, how I didn't see any effects until a long time later and discovered that it had changed the face of America as far as community arts councils were concerned. It's very difficult to plant these ideas, but once they're planted, they take on a life of their own and they move along. L.G. Sorden, who was one of the great community developers of all time, he was county agent in Rhineland. He was the second cooperative extension agent hired in the state. And I remember him saying to Professor Gard, Professor Gard was complaining that things weren't moving faster on the arts in the small community. And LG said, Bob, he said, we preached contour plowing for 40 years before people started doing. He said, now look around you. He said, they're all doing contour plowing. He said, we preached alfalfa for 40 years and people didn't want to grow it. Now it's all over the place. And these things have a way of moving at their own pace. And you as a community developer can start that movement, and maybe it'll work and maybe it won't, but you don't know.
So, you know, the phrase keeping the faith comes to mind. What's the faith?
Well, I don't know. Whatever it is, I lost it. Because I finally got so discouraged with the whole thing that I got out of. Plus, as I said, I learned it was not a sin to make money. And I think the faith is, I think the faith is that you have the right to make mistakes, and that the things that you suggest and try to foster may turn out in a whole different way from the way you thought they were going to turn out. And just very basically, I mean, the faith that what you're doing amounts to something. You know, that it does make a difference, that you're not just nuts. And you know, think about this stuff. I mean, I'm preaching to the choir here as I look around this table, because you've all done countless projects that have turned into great things and have gone on. But imagine the people that sit in factories making jeans. Or imagine the people who crunch numbers. Suppose one of them had to do an interview like this one today after 50 years and they look back on their lives. Who have they affected? What have they done? I mean, we act in this society as though money is everything. And what we tend to lose track of is that making things happen is where the fulfillment can come.
So the last lines of the book that George quoted a couple of minutes ago, that it's about altering the face and the heart of America, what does that mean to you? There's probably as many interpretations as there are people at this table, but what's it mean to you?
Well, it means exactly what it says. no more, no less. It means that if we can, make the arts a real part of daily life, that we can change the face of America. I think it's already started to change. Empowering people, giving them opportunities to express themselves, helping them to see that there's a broader horizon than what they may think there is. That's what I mean by changing the face of America. Moving society to a whole new level on the evolutionary scale. As simple as that.
That's the perfect way to end this.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you all. We really appreciate this opportunity.
And
the amazing conversation.
Robert Gard Foundation thanks everyone for your participation. And Mike, thank you so very much for joining us and sharing this incredibly important story.
Thank you.
The Oral History Program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in Detroit. Thank you all.